So this morning we're talking about intrusion and data breaches. So a data breach is the intentional or unintentional release of secure or private confidential information to an untrusted environment. Incidents range from concerted attack by black hats associated with organized crime, political activists or national governments, to careless disposal of used computer equipment or data storage media. This morning, Tom Allen, CEO of Ofengo, will cover examples of situations where data breaches occurred, the consequences, and what the company could have done to prevent the problem. He will also include a discussion of how to meet the new FAR requirements for secure systems that must be met by December 31st, 2017, including specific recommendations on what small to large companies can do to secure their systems. With more than two decades of facilitating, teaching, and most importantly, real-life, in-the-trenches business experience, Tom is dedicated to helping business professionals and entrepreneurs understand how to create well-thought-out, well-executable business plans and roadmaps to take their ideas and businesses to the next level. He's advised tech startups and established telecom businesses owners and executives to succeed where others have failed. Comfortable in the boardroom and also on the factory floor, he's led teams at all organizational levels and across many industries. Tom holds an executive MBA from the University of Florida and is an avid pilot. And in his spare time, Tom serves as a judge for Texas A&M, University of Texas at Dallas, Lamar University Business Plan competitions. Please welcome me and enjoy in welcoming Tom Allen. Thank you.
Thank you, Craig. So, has anybody in here heard of a data breach in the last 12 months or so? Has anybody been impacted by one? Well, you know what? I have. I've had my Discover card replaced three times because they contacted me and they said, just on the perchance that I've been breached, they sent me a new data card. And just last week, my daughter had someone use her identity to buy a new, I think it was a Mercedes somewhere in Virginia, and they made one car payment, and then they disappeared off the face of the earth, so they called her up and wanted to know if she intends to pay for this car. So these days, we're under what we call the advanced persistent threat. And the advanced part of that is that there are people out there, geniuses, that are creating creative ways and new technologies and all kinds of ways to get into your network. And what's really important about it is a lot of times it starts with them targeting your network. They target you or they target your company, and they decide that they're going to get in, and then they do a lot of research. They do a lot of figuring out who the employees are, and they decide that they're going to get in. So that's the advanced part. The persistent part is this. They're going to get in. They will stay at it. They will work on it, and they'll stay until they get in. And they'll stay there until they achieve their goal, which is the threat. The threat being that they're going to take all of your data and export it outside of your company. So these days, what you have to do is you have to have continuous adjustment of your security baseline. What that means is, in the past, we used to build these secure networks, and then we say, oh, my network is secure, so now I'm good. That's not the case anymore. You have to continuously look at your security baseline and figure out what you're going to do. You have to detect when somebody's, whoa, wrong button.
Security breach.
They've got to detect that somebody's in there. You've got to remediate it, and then you have to do something to protect yourself against the next breach, assuming that they were able to do the same thing. It used to be, we've got somebody trying to breach our slide right there. It used to be up until about 2007 that a hacker was somebody in a dirty T-shirt and a pizza box, and they broke into your network for fun. It was entertaining. They did it. It was just everything they could imagine was breaking in and seeing what they could do. But somewhere along there, in around 2007, it got to be business. Foreign governments and organized crime figured out that there was money to be made in breaking in and stealing data out of your network. And here's the part that I found when I was researching for this, I found shocking. At the end of 2016, the cumulative number of threats in the network today is 600 million. Now, just that soak in here. It's like there's 600 million identified threats in the network. There are 1 million new threats developed every day. So I want to go back to this. If somebody decides they're going to get in your network, they're going to get in your network. The question is, once they're in there, can you figure out if they're there, and can you continuously improve your baseline given that they're in there? One of the things that they figured out is that they can attack the weakest link. And what that means is, if you just look out in the world, we all go shopping, we all shop online, we do all kinds of things. What they do is they go into the weakest link, and they crack in there and they get the database. Because what they know is that a lot of people, in fact, most people, use the same email address and password for everything they do. My niece was visiting me at Christmas, and I'll just call her a big dog in a very large consulting firm here in the United States. And, you know, if you can imagine us talking about cybersecurity over Christmas, I mentioned this to her, and she goes, "I do that." Now think about it. She uses the same email address and password for everything. She got an email from someone that she thought was phishing, but she clicked on it. She said, "Hey, I clicked on it. But it didn't go to a website, so I'm okay, right?" No, you are not okay. You have been breached. So now I know that a very large consulting firm here in the United States has been breached, and at least they have one access point. I said, your next mission is to go to your IT department and fall on your sword and tell them what you've done. Now, the other thing that I've noticed about this, too, is let's say I go into somewhere and I find a bunch of names, and or if I identify a company I want in. You know, I go to LinkedIn and find out just about all the employees' names of all the, every company. And so it's just right there for me. I can go do that this afternoon. And if I can't find on LinkedIn, I can go Facebook. If I go to Facebook, I might find out where you bank, where you shop, and now I have all your email and passwords to all those things that you do. So this is basically what happens. One of the tried and true techniques for a hacker is the phishing attack. Anybody in here got a phishing email today? I get phishing emails. I probably get one every day. Sometimes I get two or three a day. One that I got recently I thought was kind of interesting. I was expecting a package from FedEx. I get an email from FedEx. Says, "Hey, we couldn't deliver your package. Click here to go find out what to do." And I'm like, FedEx doesn't send emails. So I didn't open it because I knew that that was a phishing attack. The thing is, they're getting much better at sending emails that look legitimate. There's a colleague of mine that, to know him, you'll know this is funny, but you don't know him, so you may not. He was on a business trip, and I get an email from him from his email address. And he said, "Hey, while I'm out of town, would you take care of this financial transaction for me?" I read that. I immediately called him and said, "You've been hacked. Somebody found out how to crack into his email." And that's what can happen to you, too. Once they crack in your email, they can send legitimate emails to people that you work with. And it's from them. I get emails regularly saying, "Would you check the invoice for the components that you bought to make sure it's correct before we ship it?" Well, if I'm in a large company and I'm getting that, maybe somebody else, and maybe I'll open that up. Maybe I'll just do that. So the point is, once they're in, they're in. Now this right here, I know it's a little bit of an eye chart, but over here, this is like your network. And out here is the bad guy. A friend of mine works at Cisco, and they took all their employees down to train them on not opening phishing emails. And they sent them all back to work after the training. And then what happened was they had an infiltration company test that, so they sent emails to all the employees. Some significantly large percentage of the employees opened emails. Now, you got to remember, they don't need everybody to open it. They just need one person to open it. Once they're in, they're in. So over here, what happens is, once they're in here somewhere, they reconnaissance around the network, and the advanced threat, remember, it's not detectable. They are running around your network. You don't know it. On average, a hacker is in your network for 240 days before you have your first clue. Now think about that. They're in there for a long time, traversing around your network. What they do then, once they find and how to exploit privileges, they exploit the privileges of the people who have equipment in the network. They stage an export of the data, and then at some point they export it. What's important nowadays, though, is after they export your data, they go in there and extract every piece of evidence that they had that let you know who they are. And if you look in the news, they're always talking about who got in, and they go, well, we can't figure out who got in. It's because they don't leave any evidence of who got in. The other thing is that I used to believe about this, and I think a lot of people still do, is that they're looking for your database. But it turns out there's data all over your network. Does anybody in here have a report in their inbox or in a file that somebody sent you a report on customer information or whatever? And so there is data all over your network. And people keep it, and they send it around, and they just do whatever they want to with it. The other thing that's happening these days, and this is actually becoming more and more popular because it appears to be more profitable, is ransomware. So you get this email, and unfortunately you click on it, and you get this message right here. It says that we've just encrypted all your files, and you have to pay this money in order to get your data back. And a couple of things happen. Is if you pay that, they know you're willing to pay, so they'll do it to you again. If you don't pay that, look in the news. Everybody know about David Beckham? Somebody hacked his database where he had a bunch of emails. So the threat here is, oh, don't pay the ransom. Not only am I not going to give your data back, I'm going to publish all your data to the world so they can see all the embarrassing things you've been sending around in email. The other thing that's probably more important is, these guys are smart enough to encrypt your data. They may not be smart enough to give it back to you. There are people out there who paid the ransom who did not ultimately get all of their data back, so they got some of it or none of it. So that's it. And I think they determined that this is actually something that's a little more profitable. Now, the DOS attack is really about disrupting your business. And here's the way I think about it. I think about the internet being like the road system. If you think about, we all drove here this morning, and we all had varying degrees of experience with the traffic, right? And like I did, I didn't have any traffic. Others probably had some more. But what they do in the internet is they drive so much traffic that they disrupt the ability for people to get to your website. So think about it like this. If I took all the tributaries into the Dallas-Fort Worth area and I dropped 1,000 cars in each one of those and I gave them instructions to be here at 7 o'clock in the morning, what do you think would happen? None of us would get here because the whole road system would be clogged up. Our company has our servers at a colo in California. About a year and a half ago, somebody launched a serious DOS attack. We were down for 18 hours before they were able to go back upstream and figure out where it's all coming from. A few weeks ago, we got hit with something that was new to me. It's called an inside DOS attack. Imagine that if we could drop 50,000 cars in this parking lot out here and tell them to all leave here at 7 o'clock in the morning. What do you think the chances are any of us would be here right now? So what they did is they went to our colo, they did an inside-out attack, and flooded traffic on the app going out so that you couldn't actually get back in. Everybody's heard about data breaches, I'm sure. And a couple of them up here are notable, like Target. And Target is actually relevant to what we're going to talk about in a few minutes. Target, they went in through a contractor portal. Remember, they're going after the weakest link. So they had a contractor portal. They cracked into the contractor portal, took over the privileges of the contractor, and went into the Target network and did. They stole all these records that they came out with. The other one up here is Home Depot. Everybody know what a Home Depot looks like? You know, big yellow building with a big orange banner out front. A few years ago, somebody wanted to do a test on hacking, so the reporter drove a hacker up in front of Home Depot in a van. And immediately they could see the SSID of the Home Depot wireless network called Home Depot. The hacker guessed the password on one try. What do you think the password was to the Home Depot building with the orange banner?
Password.
Home Depot.
Address.
Orange. See, we would all think Home Depot, I would. But he just, orange, and he was in. Now, you got to remember, he's in the inside of the network of Home Depot. Okay? And he did it on one try. The state of Texas, just a few years ago, was hacked. They lost 3.2 million records of Texans of their personally identifiable information, including their Social Security numbers. And Susan Combs, the comptroller, fired her entire staff as a result of having lost all that information. So the economic impact really is this. For hackers and insiders, it costs about almost $5 million to recover from a data breach. For human error, which is your own employees, it's almost $4 million. And if you can read this eye chart, the hackers actually sometimes have people on the inside that are colluding with them. It costs, on average, about 20% of the company's revenue to deal with a data breach. Some lost over 20% of their customers because of the loss of reputation and to the confidence of the user. We have a Target close by our house. I have to tell you, I was very concerned about buying anything there for quite a while. Some lost over 20% of their revenue. So you can see a data breach has some pretty significant impact. It turns out your greatest threat is actually your own employees. Now, has anybody in here seen Office Space?
About 100 times.
About 100 times? Okay. Office Space is an example of what's going on. These three men are upset because they think they're going to be laid off. So, what if you watch this clip, what you notice is this guy right here that we're looking at, he actually created the virus right there on his computer inside the office. And then he passed it to this gentleman right here.
On a floppy disk.
Yeah, right. I'm dating all of ourselves. You actually remember the floppy drive. But you see how easy this is? So everybody's actually seen this movie, right? I watched it the other night just so I could be ready for this. So now what they've done is they launched this thing on the inside of the network, and if you remember, what they were doing is taking the rounding errors or the roundings down on the financial transactions and putting that money into their checking account. And much to their surprise, the next day they had like $300,000 and they didn't know what to do about it. So a few years ago, I was consulting with a security company in Seattle, Washington. And I got them a meeting at Homeland Security in Washington, D.C. We had to tell Homeland Security who was coming 3 months in advance so they could vet all of us. When we get there, we have to sign in a log. We have to show our picture IDs. when our escort comes against us, we had to go through magnetometers just like you do at the airport. Big deal, right? We think we've done jump over some hoops. They take us to a conference room, and we sit down. Our escort comes back a few minutes later and says, "I am so sorry. The gentleman that you came here to see was called away to Virginia on an emergency. And we need to do this meeting by conference call. Do you have your presentation on a USB drive?" My blood is running cold at that second because we're on the inside of the firewall at Homeland Security. And so we said, "Yes, we do." And she said to our gentleman who has it, "Would you walk out here to this cubicle, to this unattended PC, and email your presentation to this email address in Virginia?" He gets up. He walks outside, unattended, to the cubicle, plugs in the jump drive, and emails it to Virginia, and we had a very successful meeting. Now, what is wrong with that picture? And here's the thing about employees. They're not criminals. They're unwittingly trying to just be helpful. She was doing a great job of being helpful, and she's made that meeting successful as a result of it. Now, here's what we could have done. We could have infected that PC. Now, somebody is going to drive home this afternoon and tell this story, and somebody's going to say to you, "Oh, Tom, that PC was firewalled off. It was on the guest network. That wasn't a big deal." But here's the thing. Once you infect that PC, then you infect every jump drive that gets plugged into it from that point forward, and there's no telling where those go or what happens to them. It turns out that one of the easiest ways for me to break into your company is to drop a few jump drives in your parking lot. What do you think people do with them? They pick them up. And they walk inside because they want to see what's on it so they can decide to give it back to somebody if they need to. At that moment, we're in.
Did that happen in the last 5, 6, 7 years? How many years ago was that at Homeland Security?
I was there about 5 years ago.
Yeah.
So, but even then, see, I think the hack at Los Alamos Labs, where it was the employee that had all the data out in their trailer house, was all still there too. So, anyway, my point is this: it's your employees. They are your greatest threat, wittingly or unwittingly. So you have to work on that. So the National Institute of Standards and Technology came out with NIST 800-171. It's about protecting controlled, unclassified information in a non-federal system. So it's contractors working with the federal government. It was published in June of 2015, and it was updated in January of 2016. The basic tenet is for you to design and maintain. The operative word here is maintain. Remember, it's continuous adjustment of your security baseline. So it's designed and maintained a secure network. And implementation is required by December 31st of this year. So it's not something that you really have a choice about doing. It's February now, so you've got to think about how you're going to get there. So, greatest risk of your employees, right? So the first thing you do is you've got to give them security awareness training. That's your first line of defense, is train them about phishing attacks, train them on how to deal with secure documents and things like that. Make sure they understand what all the expectations are. The next thing you've got to do is you've got to figure out how to authenticate who they are. You know, and a lot of companies, you know, well, I'm going to say some I have experience with, they're not real good about having everybody have a different username and password. So you've got to make sure that you authenticate, and then you've got to decide what is it that they're authorized to do so that they can't do things they're not authorized to do. The next really important thing is you've got to be able to account for it. So when something goes bump in the network, You've got to be able to go get out all the logs and find out who was logged in, where were they, what time, and what were they doing. So this is normally referred to as AAA security. It's authentication, authorization, and accounting. The next thing is you've got to limit information system access. So if you're a larger organization, you've got multiple projects, not everybody can have access to everything. So each group or each project, you've got to decide what it is that they have access to. And you've got to limit their transactions as well. So it may be there's a lot of things that you can transact, but not every project and not every person should have the authority to transact everything that's transactable. Does that make sense? The next thing you got to do is secure the endpoints. So what you have to do is install and underline maintain security applications. And almost everything nowadays, like antivirus and things like that, they all call them security applications. So whatever it is, anti-malware, is you've got to install and maintain these at the appropriate revision level. You've got to, as this is me talking, by the way, to the best of your ability, use multi-factor authentication. Passwords and user IDs are not really good enough anymore. You've got to either, when somebody tries to log in, send them a text message to their cell phone that tells them, okay, you enter this code that you can get in, or use their thumbprint, or use facial recognition or something so you can absolutely identify who this person is. Complex passwords, at least 12 digits. What's surprising about this is 2017. In 2015, somebody told me, they said, hey, you got to have all your passwords, you got to get up to 10 digits. You know how much work that is to go in there and try and get all your passwords to 10 digits? It's a lot of work. And now, 1 year later, in 2016, in order to secure your password, it's got to be 12 complex digits. That's letters, numbers, and special characters. And make sure you use a different password for everything you do. Because remember, if they get in one place, they're going to get in everywhere if you use the same one. Remember the story about the Homeland Security? Nowadays, PCs, they got several USB ports. You've got to lock those down. If you have an organization with a bunch of PCs in it, and it has a DVD player in them, and it has a USB port, you are wide open to the employee plugging something in there, either unwittingly or wittingly. Like our lady at Homeland Security was being helpful. Somebody maybe ought to have had that USB port on lockdown. Encrypt all your data and emails to the best of your ability, because these people will capture these things in while they're being transmitted. And if you just think about your emails, do you want somebody capturing them while out there in cyberspace somewhere and deliver them to the world? Backup daily. And more importantly, verify the restore. I can't even count the number of people who do a great job of backing up their system, but when something goes bump, they find out they cannot restore their business back to operation. And I meant to mention this earlier, but I was talking to a company in Virginia that got hit with ransomware. So they get hit with ransomware. Even though they had everything backed up, even though they could restore their business, it still took 5 days. They were out of business for 5 days to get their system back up and running. But having a backup is your only real defense right now to a ransomware attack. And, again, verify the restore. What a lot of people really make a mistake on. I've seen myself do this. You back up all the data, but you don't back up the applications that's needed to actually operate on the data. And so here's what happens to you. You create this data. There's an application update, and this old application is no longer available, and you didn't back it up. You restore that data, but you can't do anything with it because you don't have the application any longer in order to take care of that. And you might have to also physically restrict access. So, in some buildings, you know, with different projects, depending on what's on those computers, you may have to restrict access physically, like you'd be in a physically different room or something like that, in order to keep keep everybody from getting to everything. Default passwords. A lot of people get an access point out of the box, plug it in, and just leave the passwords for what they are so that these are defaults. You cannot have or use default passwords in a secure network. You need a complex passphrase. So, and again, a passphrase is what lets you in, and these days it needs to be complex and needs to be 12 digits. Now this one, not actually in NIST 8171, is kind of something I think you should do, is that's obscure the name of the access point so that when somebody just drives by, they can't see it. Turns out serious hackers who kind of know what's in there because they're targeting your company can actually go and, you know, listen to the transmissions and figure out what your SSID anyway is. But still, you know, it's one of these things where you use all tools that are available to you. And the spec does call out that you have to have guest networks. So when somebody comes into your office and they want to get onto your Wi-Fi, you've got to have a guest network for them that restricts their access to anything else that they shouldn't have access to. Okay, and thanks to LML Security for loaning me this slide here so I can kind of talk to you this morning. If you have a company that's large enough to have multiple projects, one of the things you'll do is you'll divide your project, your equipment up along project lines. And each project may have different levels of authority and different things that they have access to. So the project one here may not have access to everything that project two has access to. So the first thing you do is you set up all these groups and you set up all of the things that these people can do in those particular projects. Does that make sense? The next thing that happens is you have different kinds of equipment. So like in this example here, you've got Windows 7, Windows 10, Windows XP, and lo and behold, somebody over there's got a Windows 98 machine. How they manage to keep up with that is an amazing thing. But so one of the things that you have to do, though, is you have to do dynamic grouping. One of the real keys to keeping up your network these days is have all this stuff happen unattended. You can't have somebody, a person looking out at 10,000 machines out there trying to decide whether or not they're up to level with security and security applications. This has to happen unattended. So this system here does dynamic grouping and groups all the different operating systems by together regardless of which project they're in. And now what you have is in the projects, you have the security authorizations and authentications that you're allowed to have. And then based on the operating system, you may in fact have different types of security protocols for the different operating systems. So that, and this happens automatically so that you don't have to be there to watch it happen. Then what happens is this. There's a compliance violation. Quite simply, you went on a business trip, you took your laptop with you. While you were gone, there was an update to the security application. There was an update to the security patches in the OS. You were out of town and you don't have them. You come back in, you plug in your laptop, and suddenly it goes, oh, you are violating the compliance of this network. And now you are not allowed to exercise your privileges as a part of your group because your equipment is in violation. Now, the first thing that happens is the network management system gets trapped. The IT administrator gets an email. They didn't get a phone call at 3 o'clock in the morning to get them out of bed. They got an email that says, we've already taken care of this. Trouble ticket is entered. The network is resegmented. You may have a host configuration change, all while you're in the compliance group, until the problem has been remediated. And now, once you have resolved the problem, they are now able to exercise the privileges of the group that they originally belonged to for the purposes of accomplishing their job. Does that all make sense? Rodney, do you want to add anything to that? Am I missing anything?
No, I'm glad to hear that the people that came up with this new standard kind of read our data sheet and said that was necessary.
Okay.
Have you talked to anyone about that in the group again? I mean,
so, oh, now here's the other thing that happens. Let's say over in Project One, they upgraded some PCs to from 7 to 8. The system would automatically determine that, oh, those used to be 7s, now they're 8s, and reapply whatever the Windows 8 security policies are so that it happens automatically. Okay? Now, I know this is an eye chart, but one of the things you've got to have is behavioral analytics. And what this amounts to is you plug in a box into your network, and it analyzes all the traffic. And if I was one of the geniuses that delivers it, bring this up, I'd tell you more about it. But what it basically does, it determines what is normal traffic in your network, and as long as everything is normal, it's good. It doesn't do anything. But if anything happens outside normal, like a malware gets in or trying to export your data, it sends up flags that something has changed in your network and you've got to go do something about it. So it will tell you that based on how it analyzes all this traffic. Now, thanks to Sentinel IPS for providing this slide here. The last thing you got to do is you got to protect your perimeter. So you've got this network, and if you look at this right here, here's the intrusion prevention box, and here's your network, and then here's the internet. What basically happens here is you want to stop anything coming into your network that is already known and knowable as identified threat. So what this box does is it has all these rules and scripts that it gets from the industry, and if somebody tries to get into your network that is known to be bad, it does not allow that into your network. The other thing that it does deep packet inspection. These geniuses have figured out that they can take a legitimate packet that's going into your network and add and malform that packet and put some malware in it. And so the intrusion prevention looks at packets and sees whether or not they're malformed or not. And if they are, it rejects them from getting into your network. The last thing it does, which I actually think is very, very interesting, is let's say somebody sends in a phishing email and they get into your network. A lot of these malwares have to beacon back out to the hacker in order to be effective. So what this intrusion prevention box does, in addition to keeping people from getting in, is it keeps these malwares from beaconing back out to their attacker on the outside so that they can't traverse and grant credence to themselves inside the network. Natalie, you want to add to that?
That was great.
Okay, thank you very much. Good to have friends. I came over here to talk about IT security, but in the NIST standard, there's some other things in there about physical security. One is you've got to sanitize and destroy any media that you plan to reuse. So if there's any kind of paper, USB drives, or whatever they are, you can't just go throw them away. You've got to sanitize them before you give them away. You've got to limit it. Physical access to people who have authorization to be in that area. Now, this is probably 10 years ago now. I went to a very secure facility in Miami, and this has only happened to me once. We walk in there, and we sign in and everything. They give us an RFID that we're required to carry. It's part of your badge. Your escort has an RFID also, and a security guard is watching on a monitor, watching us walk around the building. If I ever got more than 4 feet away from my escort, someone would step out of the shadows and say, "May I help you?" And they told me, "Do not do that because you're not going to want the help they're going to offer you." And the thing is, that is all about everybody knowing where you are, what you have access to, and what you're going to do about it. You got escort visitors. Nobody gets in unescorted. And you've got to make sure you have a real good activity log of where they are. So I'm going to wrap up with a story about my dad, who worked at E-Systems in Greenville for 35 years. And the thing I'll tell you is I saw in 60 Minutes one night that the reason the government liked to work with E-Systems was because they knew how to keep the secret. And I got to tell you, I don't know that I know to this day what my dad did out there, except that he was a flight engineer. So picture this. They always flew in the middle of the night. He'd go out there, and they'd get the flight crew on the airplane, and they'd put them in the cockpit, and they would lock the door behind them. And they would hear noise for about 2 hours. And then someone would knock on the door, and that meant they could take off and go wherever they were going. And when they got back, they would hear a bunch of noise back there. And then someone would come up and unlock the door so you may exit the plane. And here's what I understand about that. He and the flight crew had no idea what they were doing back there. What equipment? Nothing. And as I understand it, the people in the back of the plane had no idea where they flew to. And that's all about compartmentalizing the secret. And if you compartmentalize things properly and do a good job of it, then you have a situation where nobody can know anything. All right. Any questions?
Got time?
Oh. Go ahead.
Yes. Have you been involved with Tempest Systems?
No, I haven't. What, is there something specific about them? That...
Yeah, they're very secure.
Oh.
You can't even get in to the room where they are unless you're properly ID.
Oh,
they
yeah.
do not have any signals going out or in.
There is a, I'm familiar with places like that. There's one in the Infomart. You couldn't find this if you tried. You can only know about it if they tell you about it and they're expecting you. When you walk up to the door and ring the doorbell, there's a video camera that they look at you and decide whether they're going to let you in or not. When you go in, they look you all over, and then the other thing they do is they put you in a man trap. And I don't know, they do all kinds of stuff before you actually get inside there. But the thing to see, I think, interesting about it is you can't know about them, and you can't go there unless they bring you.
You talked about email. I just want to make sure. So when they send you an email, is it actually the email opening, or is it the link within the email?
Well, I do think that there's probably some where it's just opening the email. I wouldn't open an email under any circumstances unless you're certain of where it came from. The other thing that I do, by the way, and I've seen it recommended, is I have a, what I call a sandbox. If I'm curious about it, but I'm not sure, I'll open it in my sandbox so there's nothing that's going to happen there. Does that make sense? Or like another PC or something like that. But if there's a URL or a PDF and you click on either one of those, you're done.
Right.
Yes,
if I could just elaborate a bit on that. Google, as part of Google Labs, experiments with a number of things. One of the features that you can get on Gmail is it's not an auto receipt, but you can find out if someone's opened up your email. And what they do is they embed a tag in your email. So it doesn't require someone clicking on it. It's a script that's automatically run when your email is opened. So it's very passive in that sense. And that's a very common hacker thing. So you don't actually have to click on it.
See, that's the thing about this. Is that I'm going to go back to this. If they want in and you're the target, they're getting in. The only question is what do they do with it, your data, once they've got it.
Just curious, once they are in, the activity that happens at that point, is it typically automated or is there a clever person, an individual human being orchestrating it? Or is it a hybrid?
I'm going to go back and kind of give you a non-answer. There's 600 million threats out there. I'm going to assume that some of them can be automated, but I think it's also true that what they want to do is get command of your network so they can traverse around your network at will. So, like, for instance, you've got this Sentinel IPS box in there and you're not beaconing out, somebody's going to figure out how they can, go around it. That's why you've got to go to this. It's continuously updating your security baseline. No matter what goes on, this is a war like any other war. They get better, you get better, they get better, you get better. So I don't know that I know the answer directly to your question when you ask it, but I'm going to suspect that there are some things out there that are sophisticated enough to transition around.
If they've gotten into your system, into your network, and they've planted files in there, are your backups going to have those files sitting there? So as you restore your system, you're just putting it right back into the network again? I mean, I understand about holding your ransom.
Yes.
But I would think over time they would just say, well, we've got you. We'll just sit here and wait for a month or two or three before we pull the trigger. When you put your backup in, I've got you again, and you better pay me in again.
That's a really good point. Remember, if they're in there on average 240 days before you figure it out, what you have to do on your backups is you have to have backups and a history of your backups so that you can always find and go back to a known good one. Because if you just have, like, yesterday's backup, you're probably not okay. If you have a strategy around it where you keep maybe a couple years' worth and maybe every day for 90 days and then every week and then every month or something like that. But in my experience in trying to restore systems, figuring out what is a good restore point so that you can get back to where you were can be complicated. And, in fact, you're probably going to lose something because things happen, right? If your last good restore point is 6 months away, you've lost 6 months' worth of information. Yes, sir.
Do you have recommendations for how we should treat our own personal smartphones and tablets?
Well, you know, there's a lot about that nowadays, but what I would do is, if I was your company, I would not allow you to have access to the network with any of your mobile devices or iPads or anything like that. And with a product like the one we showed with Elemental, you can actually compartmentalize those to make sure they can't get on based on what kind of device they are. But here's the problem with those, and I do a little bit of consulting around HIPAA, and here's what you got to imagine. You're at the hospital, you look awful. The nurse walks in with their iPhone, and they take a picture of you, which is out of network. Remember, they don't have control of it. They send it to their nursing friend, and they say, look what I'm dealing with tonight. And a nursing friend takes a picture of somebody else and sends it back and goes, oh, that's nothing. Look what I'm dealing with tonight. Hospitals have a lot of trouble with mobile devices like that. And the other thing is they all got camera phones. If you have a secure facility, I would highly recommend that you do not allow anybody in there with a smartphone with a camera. In fact, I know a company that is a German manufacturing company. If you walk in there with your cell phone and you want to have your cell phone available to you while you're at work, he takes a nail and a hammer and takes out your camera because their manufacturing facility is all intellectual property. And like this, about a year ago, you came in here and presented all that stuff from Lockheed. You can't have people running around that place with cell phones, right? I mean, and picture cameras, you just can't.
If you're going into meetings and so forth, you have to put your cell phone in the box.
When we went out to Raytheon to the tour last year, they told us to keep our phones in our pocket.
Yeah.
And they also said that if you pull it out of your pocket, something bad's going to happen. I don't know what that is, but I'm certain that you would not enjoy it.
That's right. Be destroyed.
The big thing out in the marketplace, of course, all across the world, is the Internet of Things.
Oh, yeah.
And IBM is going around proclaiming in the next few years there will be over 55 million billion devices.
Yeah, there are.
Interconnected. And this device is not just a personal,
right?
It is also a business device.
Yeah, that's right.
So if you know, how do you protect with the Internet of Things with all these devices interconnected?
Well, one of the things that's happening with the Internet of Things is there are so many of them, and there are people who are using those and put what they call bots on them. They break into your network. So at some point, you know, like today, I think what you got to do is maybe figure out how to compartmentalize some of that. And I don't know that I know the answer to the question you're asking, because that's going to be a big problem.
I don't think anybody knows
either. I don't think anybody knows either, but if you just think about it, if your refrigerator is telling people things or whatever, everything, it tells everything to everybody, right?
Yeah, last week I was in Los Angeles, and someone in the audience was talking about he got hacked because someone broke into the microchip in his refrigerator.
Yeah, right.
Can't trust your refrigerator.
You can. It's like this. And if you just think about the places you've been and things you've done, it's the unwitting employee who, being helpful, somehow let somebody into your network. So everything that this NIST standard talks about and everything I talk about today is you've got to protect your network from your employees. Right? You've got to keep the antivirus up to date. You've got to lock down those USB ports. You've got to keep them from doing things that they would do otherwise. And even this, we used to have this catchphrase called written policies are not enough. It's because you have all these written policies, and you can pass an audit because you've got written policies. Right. And passing an audit does not mean you're secure. Passing an audit just means you pass an audit. So if you have a, if we imagine that Homeland Security person having a written policy that says don't let people stick USB drives into these PCs, she did it. We did it.
One other question. What are you involved with on the cloud?
Well, our servers are in the, well, it depends on who you're asking about. My company, Opango, does everything in the cloud. The Elemental server that Rodney can answer questions about actually can be in the cloud, and if you have applications or virtual machines in the cloud, those can be protected too. But the thing that's really important to understand about the cloud, other than that, is has to do with a federal with law. If you have servers on your premise and the federal government wants your servers, they can issue a subpoena to you and they can get your data. If they're in the cloud, somebody else owns that. They go to them and they get your data and you don't even know about it.
Right.
So that's my advice is on the cloud, and what I see just companies do is they keep the really important stuff in a locked-up room somewhere, and they put a lot of the other stuff in the cloud. Yes, sir.
Yeah, for locations like campuses,
yeah.
Would you have any recommendations saying that, you know, you need, like, open access almost all the time, and then with, you know, universities becoming, like, a prime source for, you know, attackers, would you have any, you know?
Well, I have a daughter who graduated from Florida State, and she was also up at Austin College. So my recommendations are going to come a little bit like this. She got hacked so badly at Austin College that it took me 3 months to clean up her machine to get it back to be useful. So, and then she went to Florida State, and what I noticed when I went down there to help her is there were so many wireless networks were all over the place. What I would do if I was at a university, I think, is I would probably sit in a room and figure out the fact that you're going to have a bunch of students that are all going to need access to stuff and figure out how to compartmentalize the network so they can't get to things that they should get to and so that they can be protected from hackers. I mean, if you think about it, you show up in a city with a laptop and you're near the campus and you log into their network, you're a prime target. So what they did not do for my daughter was spin her up with what she needed to do to protect herself. So I don't know if that answers your question, but when I think about it, you just have too many people and too many opportunities for somebody to infect the network. It goes back to this. If you go read through this NIST standard, it's all about compartmentalize everything.
Yeah.
Figure out who is authorized and who is not authorized, and if they don't have all their authorizations, they don't get in. And at the universities, what I'm afraid of is if they want to get in. Does that help you? I thought you were about to ask.
Yeah, I had a question. So basically, our company has different locations,
yeah.
And we're ran on like 3 different IT systems. What recommendations do you have for a company of 225 employees that's operating on different IT systems?
Well,
I mean, I would think that just after hearing what you spoke about, that's kind of
it is. I mean, what you described to me is where are you located? Here's what you've got to do. Is what I want to do is sit down with you and think about what all you're actually trying to accomplish because there's just too many things. But I want to know who should and should not have access to what, and you'd want to have all these remote locations sort of under one umbrella. I don't think I'd want different managed service providers trying to manage each one of those unless you have some sort of high-level person look over it all. And the number one thing, I'm going to say this again, whatever you're doing right now, just because you have a secure network today doesn't mean you'll have one tomorrow. Doesn't mean we have one right now. You've got to have systems that operate unattended, that will limit access when something goes bump and not get access granted again until whatever that problem is resolved. You cannot have people involved in it other than maybe the resolution or remediation part.
Which, on a personal basis, what recommendations would you make for us on our laptops, our PCs at home? Would you say one piece of advice or two?
Well, your PCs at home, I have a home network, and I have a wife and a daughter. And make sure that they all have antivirus running on them. And make sure that you, like I have a backup server at home. It doesn't have access to the Internet, things like that. But I think at home, you might be able to get an intrusion prevention software. I don't know if your product is fitted for like a home use or something like that, typically, but I do want to tell you one thing. If you buy a new computer for home and you take it out of the box and you plug it into the network, how long do you think it takes before somebody pings it to see if they can get in? Any idea?
Mm-mm.
About 40 seconds. Now, what do you think about that? We bought a brand new computer, you pull it out of the box, and that's why I think a lot of
where
them would be.
Where do they hang out at?
Do what?
Where do they hang out at? I mean, do they have to go that far from your house? Or?
No, they're just in the network. They're out there in China or Russia or somewhere. I don't know where they're at.
They just see a new number hit.
They're just out there trolling the network all day long.
What's the Chinese company, Huawei? The government will not buy any of that equipment whatsoever because they say it's embedded.
Oh, well, that's correct.
Well,
the government contracts, you cannot buy anything that has a Chinese chip in it.
So even Levino PCs and stuff?
Yeah.
You can't buy certain PCs. Just not allowed.
That's the problem. I totally get you, but I can tell you this. If it's a foreign government and they want into the American government, they have got an army of people whose full-time job to do nothing but figure out how to get into your network. Somebody have a question?
This is also on the personal side. Imagine that you're the head of security for a major investment financial services company.
Yeah.
With millions of clients who have billions of, or trillions of dollars under your management. Do those kind of companies take it to yet another level beyond what you're talking about? Because it doesn't seem like there's any foolproof way to safeguard all that based on what you've said. It still seems like you're doing the best you can, but you're still going to get hacked.
Well, that's the sad truth about the whole thing, is that you're doing the best you can and you're probably still going to get hacked. And I'll tell you, I'm familiar with a company here in town that's a financial a group that provides funding to small companies, and they're connected to a lot of high net worth individuals. So all those people's data is in their network. And so and I would classify them as the weakest link. We were just visiting with them the other day, and they do not have, the problem is they don't have the sophistication for it. Now, I think there is another spec for those guys. It's the ISMA? Is that what it is? And they have other requirements around maintaining data and stuff like that. So I
just wonder whether they just insure themselves against the loss. I mean, if I log on tomorrow and find out all my assets are gone, I'm going to be a little upset.
You are, and here's what I do. I didn't put a slide up about this, but in the news they talk about the cost of these breaches being millions and millions of dollars. It turns out, I think the dirty little secret is this: it costs less to deal with the breach after the fact than it does to secure your system before the fact. And once companies start looking at that, they make strategic decisions to not secure their network and bet on the fact that they'll just pay for it on the other side. I think where they're misguided, though, is the idea of their reputation.
Yeah, just to add a little comment to that, I think basically why most companies, you know, have to do it is because of liability.
Yeah.
So once these breaches happen, you know, you have to, the company has to show that, you know, this, we did that, we did this, we did that, and, you know, we followed all the requirement, but we still got, you know, breached. But in the case where you got breached and, you know, they inspect your systems, they inspect your, you know, network and see that you did actually, then, you know, you'll be held liable. So
that's right. In the state of Texas case, there was a general thought that they did not take care of securing the network, and so the people who were responsible for it now have that on their resume, that they were asked to leave the state of Texas and right after the breach.
But then of all those companies you showed up there, all of them, hey, you want to hit camp, give me your email address. Hey, you want to know where our next sale is, give me your email address.
Right.
I mean, they're inviting us to come in,
right,
you know, either knowingly or unknowingly, you know, into our homes or whatever.
That's right.
Or whatever. So, I just don't know what the answer is. I know they're trying to get that data to say analyze our shopping habits, right, et cetera, but they're inviting us in by saying, oh, you know, give me your email address. And
they are.
If a phishing email comes over, it looks like Home Depot, I don't know.
Well, the problem is you don't know. You just have to kind of look at it, think about it. But I will tell you this, and this is probably some good advice for everybody in here. If you get an email from anybody that says that your password can compromise, click here and reset your password, even if you believe it, go, okay, that's fine. Go to that website and go to the change password. If you click on that link, it is very well that what they're really doing is trying to figure out what your username and password is, and you know what? You just give it to them because they asked for it.
Now, get one of those from the IRS saying, there's been a mistake, we need your information.
Well, that's a good question. The IRS doesn't send emails.
But I've seen it. Yeah, I've seen
right.
it.
Right, they don't send emails. That's the key. Everybody knows the IRS writes you a letter. You get an email from the IRS, you laugh about it, and you put it in your junk folder, you call it a day.
And somebody told me 90% of the data breaches we don't see or hear about because they're not huge. And
that's probably
one person said that what you don't see was somebody I know worked at the bank said that they're constantly replenishing funds that have been moved.
Oh, I don't doubt that.
That you never even know that you may have been, but they saw it and they put the money back.
Yeah.
And you never know.
I'll just answer that and then we'll call it a day. Your credit cards, they used to have to walk up next to you or get it at a restaurant. Nowadays they can guess the number algorithmically. And my Discover card has been guessed more than once. And I had somebody walk into an appliance store in Pennsylvania and buy a $700 television set card present. They guessed my number, they bought something. And the reason Discover cut off the card is they looked at my history and saw I've been in Dallas, Texas forever a day. I couldn't have possibly been.
Right. Thanks, Tom. Appreciate it.